This is Fresh Air, a new interview program, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is painter Frank Stella. Stella has achieved a level of fame reached by very few living artists. He made his debut at the Museum of Modern Art when he was 23, and a decade later, he became the youngest artist ever to be given a retrospective there. Stella is now 48, and his career can be divided into several radically different periods. They each created a stir in the art world, from his black canvases to his clashing, multicolored geometric forms, to his recent more improvised and painterly work. Each style left its mark on the art world, but every time Stella's influence had become obvious, Stella himself had already moved on to something else. His black paintings of the early 1960s anticipated minimal art. Many museum-goers of that time assumed these black paintings were a put-on. This work was shocking. Stella patterned these canvases with black stripes, separated by white pinstripes. From a distance, they showed no evidence of paint drips or even brush strokes. This opposed the dominant style of the time, abstract expressionism. When we talked about his work, Frank Stella told me that he never intended these black paintings as a rejection of abstract expressionism.
Maybe, in some sense, I wanted to set myself up a little bit differently from the way everybody else was working, but I really wasn't trying to be different. I mean, it's a sense in which you can be critical. I mean, maybe I had a few critical things to say about the looseness of the style of painting at the time, but I wasn't against abstract expressionism. The only kind of painting that I ever really understood and the only kind of painting I ever really cared about was abstract expressionist painting. The difference was that I tended to sort of lean towards maybe the slightly less popular side of abstract expressionism. I would tend to like maybe Barnett Newman and Adolf Gottlieb a little bit more than I would like, say, de Kooning, although I really love de Kooning too. But the second generation style of abstract expressionism was hard for me to absorb. But the first generation seemed to me to be fantastic, and that's what I was interested in.
But your paintings were so different.
Yes, they were different, but for example, you described them as having being black and having white pinstripes and not having drips, but none of those things are true. They're not white. The white was never painted. The what was called white was really just the bare canvas between the black. There were plenty of drips. They were sort of soft. They were actually more Rothko-esque than anything else. And in fact, when my paintings were first shown, Adolf Gottlieb picked one of my paintings to be in a show of older artists, picked younger artists, and he liked the black paintings. And I know that for a fact that when I had my first actual one-man show of paintings, which were the aluminum paintings at Leo's gallery about a year later, he came in with a friend and was quite disappointed in them. He didn't like the aluminum paintings at all, whereas he had liked the black paintings. And actually that is perfectly was understandable. I mean, it makes a lot of sense in a certain way because my ideas and my style hardened by the time I'd finished with the black paintings, and I was trying to be a little bit different, maybe more deliberately different, and I was really interested in other pictorial ideas by the time I saw what I'd done with the black paintings. And I was probably by then trying to separate myself from what was going on a little bit more. Although not all that much.
The black paintings were very controversial. Emile D'Antonio, who had one of your early black paintings, tells a story of
it.
Did he? Well, he tells a story of how a couple of friends came over, saw the black painting, and one of them threw some recently acquired ether on it, and the other poured her drink over it because they thought that they thought it was some kind of joke or something.
Well, an affront, yes. That happened. I mean, I guess they were, you know, I guess they struck some people as being aggressively simple. I mean, I think that it's possible to see them, or it was possible then, and maybe even now, to see them as childlike or maybe even naive. But to tell you the truth, I mean, when I look at them, I don't see them that way. I mean, you have to really force it to see them. I mean, they seem pretty straightforward paintings. It's not so clear to me that if you didn't know what the paintings were about and who did them, and I include myself in this, that you could tell that they were either from someone's early work or later work or when they were made. I mean, it's not manifestly clear looking at those paintings that those are the paintings of a young man, be he good or bad.
When you were doing the black paintings, were you uninterested in color at the time?
Well, you know, I was really learning how to paint, and I was really beginning, so I didn't have any particular stake in color one way or the other. To me, the black paintings were, you know, obviously exciting, and they were colorful. They were plenty colorful enough to me. I mean, it really was a question of dealing with what I had. I mean, I had arrived at the black paintings, obviously, by painting black over what I had been working on, but it seemed to provide something special, and it was quite colorful to me. I mean, I didn't think of it as a particularly negative statement about color, although I flirted for a long time with the idea of a non-color, of a colorless black. In fact, for a while, some of the black paintings weren't very black. I used a very cheap white paint mixed into a very cheap black enamel, which produced a kind of dark color that was really a kind of umberish black, and that had less quality of color, to my way of thinking, than a real sort of strong black. So they were called the no-color paintings, but I gave up on that because it was too funny a color. I wanted it to be more straight.
When did you know that you wanted to start working with really brash colors?
Well, my father said to me, you know, people, you need color in order to sell paintings. And when he said that, I started thinking about, you know, you can't. First, I had made black paintings, then aluminum, and then copper. And then I started to think about color. And as soon as he said that, the idea popped into my head that I could make paintings, pretty much stripe paintings, pretty much the same way I was making them. And instead of using color, I'd use something as nearly as neutral as color, which would be just use it as it came out of the can. Like, I thought of red, orange, yellow, green, blue, and violet, and just using those colors. And without, you know, without any sort of fancy relationships, just take them in the most normal kind of color wheel or spectrum relationship and use them in that way and in a fairly mechanical way. And then you'd have mechanical color, which seemed to work for me for a while.
What do you mean by mechanical color?
Well, the color would be sort of disembodied slightly from its usual sense of usual kind of artistic relationships or associations. When you saw the concentric bands, the color repeated in that sequence, they had a kind of mechanical or found look rather than an arranged look. It looked like an arbitrary or designed arrangement. And then it created a certain kind of expectation about the obvious. I mean, as though something more, I mean, as though you found something that you didn't expect to find, and yet it's what you see on children's toys, for example, all the time.
What kind of paints have you used for your color paintings?
Well, I've used all kinds, but I mean, I find it very hard to restrict myself to what are called artist colors. I mean, I use a lot of commercial paint, and maybe it's just a habit that I picked up from working as a house painter, or I'm not sure exactly why, but I like commercial paints largely because they combine sort of easily, and it changes the quality of the color. When you fine art pigments are more intense in terms of color because they actually have more color in them, more pigment. They have less inert matter in them, and most commercial paints are a lot of dirt. And so the color is sort of darker and muddier, actually. You know, the more intense colors cost more because you get more of the minerals. But it's nice to see a cheap red because you sense something cheap about it. When you see I like to play a cheap red off against an expensive red. Somehow it always sort of is interesting, at least to me anyway.
So you must mix your colors like people in paint stores do. You take big cans and you shake them up a lot, right? It's not like working on a palette, which is the traditional way of doing it.
Yeah. I mean, Bob Rauschenberg has said the whole world is his palette, but I used my whole studio floor as the palette. But basically, yeah, it's a big palette. You go from can to can, bucket to bucket. I mean, I'm fairly loose with the paint, and I don't mind if I sort of, you know, waste a lot of paint.
Can you tell us how you started getting interested in geometric form as the subject matter for your paintings?
You know, I never thought about that very much. I mean, when I was at in school, particularly at Phillips Academy, I mean, we had a studio course and we studied art history. And I mean, when I saw Mondrian and then when I saw some abstract painting in the gallery, in the Addison Gallery, the idea appealed to me immensely. I mean, it was a tremendous relief to think of the square as subject matter. I mean, it just seemed to me wonderful that I could paint squares while the guy next to me was painting a figure. I mean, when he was painting his sister, I could be painting another square. I mean, it was easy to paint a square, and I liked doing it besides. I mean, it just seemed the big advantage was that I would be able to work sort of really directly on pictorial problems without worrying about figurative technique. I mean, I simply didn't have to worry about those kind of problems. I could really worry about getting a whole picture, making a painting work in sort of general terms, and which I think are still the most important terms, the sense I could deal right away with the sense of wholeness and a sense of accomplishment. I mean, maybe the paintings weren't great, but they were accomplished paintings in the sense that they were coherent and whole right from the beginning.
Some, I think, art teachers would probably say that it's fine to do something that's abstract like that only after you've mastered the art of achieving a three-dimensional look in a painting and getting solid representational form. Do you agree with that?
No, I mean, obviously, I don't agree with it. I mean, I certainly believe that you can do anything that you want. But, I mean, I honestly, my experience has been that the best painting of the, you know, of the point and probably the best painting of the last half century has been abstract painting. I mean, there's been a drive towards abstraction for one reason or another. I mean, all of the activity takes place around the problem of abstraction. Whether it's abstract or not doesn't seem to matter so much. But, I mean, it's hard for painting now to be realistic without acknowledging that it's being realistic in the face of abstraction, which seems to be part of the problem today.
Painting sometimes becomes decoration when it's, you know, when it's purchased to put on your wall in the living room. What do you think of painting as decoration? I know it's a thought that upsets a lot of artists and that other artists find perfectly pleasing.
Well, I mean, the aim of art is to be more than decoration. I mean, if it's used decoratively, what can you say? I mean, if somebody likes something, you can't stop them from buying it. And if they decide that they really bought your purple picture because they want to hang it on their green wall, you've had it. I mean, it's going to hang on their green wall for a while. But I don't think that that's a really serious problem. I mean, if the painting will find its way to its home one way or the other eventually, and you know, if it's a good enough painting, it'll live through its life on the green wall and come to rise above it.
What do you think the purest use of painting is?
Well, actually, I don't know if there is any use of painting. I mean, I think that painting actually ends up having sort of lives or dies by its sort of sense of social responsibility. In a way, it has to be useful to society. Society has to care about it. And if it cares enough, it takes care of it. And it society finds some meaning in the painting. Whether it's really true that the artist put that meaning in there, I mean, in some cases it's hard to say, but the society has some idea about what it thinks that the painting means, and because of that it takes care of it. It values the painting.
Your recent work has gone through a new set of changes. The forms aren't strictly geometric. You're using different kinds of colors than you used to. There's more brush strokes or hand strokes, evident.
Right, it's more paint. They're basically more painterly, at least in execution.
How come that change for you?
Well, actually, the change is not so recent. It really started around 1975 when I finished the Polish constructions, which were constructions in which I used most of the color was either painted on flat, but mostly the color was sort of applied in a collage technique. Like it might be canvas, colored canvas would be glued to one of the surfaces, or felt, colored felt would be put down on another surface. And so most of the color was uninflected. And I began working on some new pieces designed to be in metal because I was having a lot of trouble with the cardboard I had been using in the Polish pieces. And when I was thinking about the surface of the metal, in order to cover it, when I first saw the pieces, they looked so industrial. I mean, they looked like, I don't know, they had the quality like they'd be a kind of logo for some kind of industrial firm or something like that, International Harvest or something like that. They look like corporate art or a kind of relief or something like that. And I wanted to mess up the surface, basically, or the metallic surface. And what came to mind was the technique to use in printing, etching, sort of scarring and etching the surface. And once I started that, I could have done that in a sort of regulated way, but it was pretty natural to etch it and draw on it in a sort of messy way and etch the surface that way. And somehow it didn't look that funny. I mean, the paintiliness, although is more textural than really brushstroke kind of thing, it seemed to work. It was, and then it just got more and more painterly as I went on.
And the colors seem to have changed too.
Well, the colors, maybe the colors, the colors obviously have changed. But once I started on the metallic paintings, I started using pretty high-keyed colors, a lot of screen inks designed for aluminum. And once I began to use the reflective quality of the metal underneath, that made the color pretty intense. And that was one of the advantages of working with the metal, that you get that reflective quality. You get some of the jewel-like quality, for example, that you often find in, say, 17th century Northern painting, where they use a lot of glazes.
My understanding is that you started doing prints after refusing to sign a loyalty oath at the University of California. Can you tell us about that?
Well, what I can remember about it, yeah. I mean, it wasn't a very strong political position. I mean, I was just mildly outraged that the state of California questioned my loyalty, which in my opinion they didn't have a right to do. I'm an American citizen, and it's not the business of the state of California to make me reaffirm what I am until I'm proven otherwise, which is a loyal American. It doesn't seem to be that. And actually, the case was won on exactly those grounds about 4 or 5 years later. So I was just offended by the presumptuousness of the state of California, and so I refused to sign the oath, and then so I didn't teach. And that left me out there in California with a house I'd rented in Corona del Mar, waiting for the Martians to land. And Ken Tyler came down and suggested some things about making printmaking to sort of pass the time, since I'd already set up house there and moved out from New York.
Have you learned things about form and color from printmaking that hadn't occurred to you from painting?
Well, things show up in a different way on paper, and the quality of paper is very difficult, very different, and it's also very difficult, but very different from the quality of, say, metal or canvas. And the sense of limit that the sheet of paper or this even handmade paper, which is made large in sheets, I mean, there's that sense of a kind of expected limit of what you should do. They always seem to be... I mean, really, the biggest limit probably isn't the paper, but the size, the width of the printing bed. And you always seem to be running off the edge of the plate of the stone. I mean, it gets annoying after a while. It's hard to be expansive.
My guest is artist Frank Stella. There have been so many, like, painting movements since you started to paint. There's been minimalist art and pop art and op art and conceptual art and the new realism. Do you follow closely what's happening? Do you go to museums a lot, and are you concerned with the movement of the day?
Well, I like to see what's going on, but I mean, I was thinking that in the 70s, for example, I worked out at Gemini a lot making prints, and I now find it hard to imagine that I spent all that time working out there, like commuting, for example, to California and everything, and that seems so interesting. And now, I mean, the last place I'd like to go is to an airport, and I don't find anything exciting about the idea of commuting to Los Angeles. But then it seemed sort of interesting, but partly because the 70s seemed sort of so boring, what was going on. I mean, it was more interesting. My life was more interesting than art, whereas in the 60s, sort of, painting seemed to be everything for me. And then something happened in the 70s where I felt that I had to, if the interest wasn't outside of me or around me, I was going to have to, if I was going to continue being an artist and continue to make paintings, I mean, I'd have to a lot of the things would have to be self-generated. I mean, it was as though I had to make my own excitement. I mean, I know that sounds a bit fatuous, but I mean, that's really the way it was. I mean, I sort of had to, a sense of sort of withdrawing in order to sort of get going again.
Did that provoke you to change your own style?
Well, I think it did. I mean, well, I think I changed anyway, but I mean, I think that one of the reasons for changing was that there was certainly nothing to be lost. So, I mean, there was no sense of fear or that, you know, no sense of loss.
You've never been a realist painter. Could you do a realist rendering if you wanted to? I mean, do you have the
skill for
that? No,
truly, if I had to draw a picture now of Mickey Mouse, I would fail.
Did that ever upset you when you wanted to become an artist? Did you ever think that someone was going to come in and test you and say, hey, we love your work, but prove to us that you can really, you know, do a rendering?
You know, it never crossed my mind. I mean, I never could see, I mean, I never had, I don't, I, to this day, I don't understand what illustration has to do with making art. It just, you know, there doesn't seem to be any point to it for me. I mean, and if I, you know, I'm sure that if I had to have people in my paintings, I'd figure out a way to put them in.
Do you think that realism dead-ended after modernism, after abstract expressionism, say?
No, I don't think, I mean, I think that the demise of attitude towards representational painting is sort of complicated. I mean, but I think that the problem is that all painting wants to be real. The question is, does representationalism doesn't guarantee the quality of realness in art any more than abstraction does? So it's always going to be a problem. But what the artist is afraid of is that his work will be artificial and not real. And this criteria can be applied to either abstraction or realism. It's my feeling abstraction has... You know, it's easier for, in some ways, for abstraction to be real than for realist painting. I mean, it's less of an artifice for abstraction to be real in the sense that painting really wants to be real than it is for representationalism.
A lot of modern art has sought after originality, to try something new, to have a breakthrough concept or something. Do you think that we put too much of a premium on originality in art? How valuable do you think that is?
Well, I think it's the most, I mean, if it's really original, it's great. I mean, you know, the big thing in the critical literature is to make a distinction between novelty and originality. And although it's nice to make that kind of distinction, I don't understand what the distinction is, or at least when I read about it, in the terms that I read about it. It's hard to know what's original. I don't think that you can find too many examples of originality. I mean, usually... I can't understand the idea of originality. I have to admit it's a difficult idea to begin with. But usually what we mean in art by originality is doing something first. And in a sense, Picasso was certainly a very original painter. If he wasn't the first to make cubist pictures, I mean, he was certainly the first to make open sculpture. And I mean, so he was a contributor on a lot of levels and a lot of ideas that were certainly around. They weren't necessarily absolutely his original ideas, but he gave them form, the first form that really sprung them loose in the world. And so there are original people like that, original people who do that kind of original work, and I think that that kind of work is rightly prized because it is relatively rare.
Let's talk a little bit about the politics of the art world. A lot of artists say that unless you have the right connections and know how to be really diplomatic, you're never going to get involved with a good gallery, and you'll never make it in the art world. How true do you think that is? How much do you think an artist's future really depends on their ability to politically navigate?
I don't think much. I mean, you can make mistakes, and you can be a pain in the rear end and bother a lot of people. But if you can make the work, then people need you. I mean, they have to have you. I mean, the one ingredient that's always lacking is ability. People are always looking for people who have the ability, and they need them. I mean, the dealers need the artists. I mean, I've said this before, and it's obvious. I mean, the dealers don't have any idea of what to make. I mean, they have to get somebody to make it for them. if they had good ideas, they wouldn't bother with the artists.
You were successful at a very young age. You were represented at the age of 24 in the Museum of Modern Art's group show 16 Painters. Did your early success generate a lot of jealousy or animosity, anything like that?
Well, no. Well, I guess maybe it did, but I didn't. I was shielded from it a little bit. I mean, you have to remember that I was. It didn't just happen to me. There were a lot of young other painters who were successful at the same. I was really one of many, and in fact, the other painters were more successful than I was. Certainly financially, they all probably did better than I did. I mean, I was a success d'esteem, but I wasn't much of a financial success. I mean, I really was in. In 1965, I was still begging Leo for money to, you know, keep my family together and to keep going. And, you know, I got kind of down. I mean, it's sort of depressing to keep having to ask for money, to always be behind and always owing people money and everything like that. It wasn't all that great.
There's an image of the artist as being heroic and romantic. And I think it's an image that was especially expressed through the work of the Abstract Expressionists and through the way some of them live their lives. What do you think of that notion of the artist as the hero, the romantic?
Well, I mean, you could say it's the artist as jerk or something. I mean, Steve Martin would maybe be the best example. But I don't have much interest in that. I mean, I pretty much go by my own life. I mean, I guess I think of myself as a painter, as someone who makes things. And I mean, I'm not particularly interested in the artistic quotient, sort of what makes up the artistic part of my life. I mean, I don't feel that artistic. I mean, I feel like a painter when I'm working on the problem of making a painting. But, you know, it's not, I mean, I don't really, I guess I have a slightly or quite a strong anti-romantic bias, I guess.
Why do you think you have that?
Well, I mean, I find it offensive to think of myself as an artist. I mean, or an artistic personality. I mean, if someone said, well, you have, some kind of sensitivity that other people don't have, it seems to be manifestly untrue. I mean, the only thing that I have is the will to make paintings. I mean, that's why I want to use what I know to make paintings, or what I'm able to understand to make paintings.
What are the other implications of the term artistic temperament?
Well, usually, I mean, it's used in terms of apology. I mean, it's a description of somebody who can't, who's either neurotic or a nuisance, and the artistic personality is used as a justification or an excuse for the kind of behavior that's on one hand interesting, but on the other hand expensive for other people to maintain.
And you don't want any part of that.
Well, I don't see to tell you the truth, I mean, painting is difficult and interesting enough for me, and time is running out. I mean, there's a lot to do, and it's hard. So, I mean, I'm busy worrying about what to do, not how to act.
Artist Frank Stella. I hope you enjoyed this edition of Fresh Air. Fresh Air is produced at WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The technical directors were Ron Barron and Joyce Lieberman. Fresh Air is edited by associate producer Maeve McGoran. Danny Miller and I co-produce the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening.
National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible by support from the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia and its 16 undergraduate, graduate, and professional schools. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.